Hello, everyone. Welcome. And thank you so much for joining. We're going to give additional attendees just another minute to pop in here, and then we'll go ahead and get started. Thanks again for joining. Hello there, everyone. Welcome and thank you for joining. It is 1 o'clock, so we are going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot of content to get through today, and we're excited to have you here, along with some very special presenters. My name is Chelsea, and I'm a consultant with Guidehouse supporting CDC's One Lab initiative. Just want to note a couple of things before we start the webinar today. If you're having any technical difficulties throughout, you can feel free to email our One Lab inbox. It's onelab@cdc.gov. That's onelab@cdc.gov. You'll see that was just popped into the chat too. If you have questions throughout the presentation, we welcome you to enter them into our Q&A function. You'll see it on the bottom ribbon of your screen. If you submit those, we're going to try our best to get to as many Q&A as we can at the end of the webinar, but any lingering questions, we'll be sure to try and reach back out with answers. You can always email questions to our inbox as well. Note that we're going to post links to live captions in our chat right now. If you want to access these live captions throughout, they'll be available through the whole session. Just be sure that if you're going to use them, that you have the live captions link pulled up and this Zoom webinar pulled up as well. You'll need both. All right, so let's go through our agenda today. We're going to start just by introducing our presenters. We're going to talk through some relevant resources that OneLab Network has posted that are relevant to today's topic. We're going to have our main presentation with some great guest speakers. We'll squeeze in that Q&A at the end, and we'll tell you about our next event we have coming up next week. So let's go ahead and introduce you to our amazing presenters today, starting with Dr. Villanueva. She's been with CDC since 2007, working in the influenza division and currently in the Division of Preparedness and Emerging Infections, where she is the Laboratory Preparedness and Response Branch Chief, overseeing the biological component of the Laboratory Response Network, or LRN. The LRN was established in 1999, and it's an integrated domestic and international network of laboratories designed to respond quickly to biological, chemical, and radiological threats and other high-priority public health emergencies. Dr. Villanueva has been engaged in several public health emergency responses at the CDC, including influenza A, H1N1, influenza A, H7N9, Zaire Ebola virus, Zika virus, COVID-19, monkeypox virus, and most recently, Sudan Ebola virus. She has taken a lead role at CDC validating, verifying performance, obtaining regulatory clearance from the FDA, and distributing clinical diagnostic tests for infectious disease. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Villanueva. Next up, we have Dr. John Klena. He's a PhD infectious diseases microbiologist whose professional career began in 1992. Dr. Klena has extensive experience in microbial genetics, microbial genomics, and pathogenicity studies. Through his work and research, John has been fortunate to be able to work across the world, although the focus of much of his teams of 10 work in Bangladesh, Bolivia, and Uganda. At CDC, Dr. Klena supervises this team of 10 and provides and performs diagnostic assays to national and international partners. The team has extensive experience in viral isolation, phylogenetic analysis of viral genomes, and the safe handling and manipulation of high consequence viral pathogens. Thank you, Dr. Klena, for joining us today. Now you probably recognize Dr. Alicia Branch if you've been on any of these OneLab Network calls today. She's our OneLab Network lead. She's a health scientist safety specialist in the Division of Laboratory Systems. Dr. Branch has more than 20 years of professional experience as an academic researcher and has served in various roles in the clinical laboratory. She supported three pandemics, including serving twice during the current pandemic as the external biosafety SME and as a laboratorian of CDC's infection prevention and control team, performing wave point of care antigen testing in three nursing home facilities. Thanks, Dr. Branch. We'll talk to you shortly. Today, we also have Dr. Trevor Shoemaker. He currently serves as the team lead for epidemiology, clinical surveillance, and health education within the viral special pathogens branch at the CDC. The team's current activities focus on the detection, response, control, and clinical characterization of viral hemorrhagic fevers. In the last few years, the team has been directly and actively involved in multiple filovirus outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Prior to becoming team lead, he served 6 years in Uganda as surveillance, diagnostics, research, and outbreak response program lead. Thank you, Dr. Shoemaker. We'll also have Dr. Brian Harcourt joining us today. He is an Ebola subject matter expert and a biosafety officer in the viral special pathogens branch. So before we give it over to our experts for the presentation, I'll turn it back over to Dr. Branch. She's going to open us up with some new resources and some resources that are really relevant for today's presentation. Dr. Branch?
Thanks, Chelsea. Before we get started with today's presentation, let me give you some of the new resources. First, we have the Department of Transportation, or DOT, and the International Air Transport Association, IATA, job aid, as you can see. And it's really for shipping by motor vehicle, carrier, ground, or air transport. And this is for hazardous materials regulations. We also have a safely packing, shipping, labeling, marking category A and B job aids. In addition, there is a packing and shipping dangerous good course. This course actually provides a general knowledge of for training packing and shipping division 6.2 infectious substances and dry ice. It is intended for public health and clinical laboratories that are involved in any step of the packing and shipping transport process of patient samples or cultures. There is a specimen shipping and guidance presentation and audio and recording. We would like to highlight the introduction of the laboratory risk management course and the Ebola specific job aid. And it's for collecting, transporting, and submitting specimens for Ebola virus testing in the U.S. Finally, I would like to highlight, we've been talking about this for a few months, and I would like to say that it's finally available. It's the Emergency Preparedness Response Guide, which covers resources for laboratories to reference for biological, chemical, and radiological emergencies. It also can be really used for training new professionals hired to support emergency responses. And now I would actually like to turn it over to Dr. Villanueva for her presentation.
Hi, everyone. I guess I'm reviewing the objectives for today. So by the end of the webinar, our learners will be able to describe background details of Ebola virus disease outbreak in Uganda caused by the Sudan virus or Sudan Ebola virus, and then also to discuss testing, packaging, and shipping considerations for submission of those specimens to the CDC or other reference laboratories. Can I have the next slide? This is our webinar outline. So I think we're going to go to John Klena for the first part on the background, if I'm not mistaken. Thanks.
Hi, Julie. This is actually Trevor Shoemaker. I'm going to just give a quick background on the current epidemiology of this outbreak that we're discussing today related to laboratory packaging and shipping. But just to put it into a bit of context, this current Sudan virus outbreak in Uganda caused by Sudan Ebola virus was first declared by the Uganda Ministry of Health on September 20th of this year in Mubende District, which is in the central region of Uganda, about 150 kilometers west of the capital city of Kampala. It's not far from where we had the last Sudan virus outbreak in Uganda, which was in 2012, which was about 70 to 90 kilometers west of this location. So it is an area where we've had previous Ebola outbreaks in the past. The first confirmed case of this outbreak was in a 25-year-old male who lived in Mubende district and presented to the regional referral hospital there. They were quickly identified as a suspect by our hemorrhagic fever due to ongoing viral hemorrhagic fever surveillance program, as well as training at that hospital to identify and report viral hemorrhagic fevers to the National Laboratory and the Ministry of Health. So a sample was quickly sent to the Uganda Virus Research Institute, which serves as the National Reference Laboratory for Viral Hemorrhagic Fevers, and was confirmed by RT-PCR on September 19th. Next slide, please. So Sudan Ebola virus is in the family Filoviridae, order Mononegrovirales in the genus Ebola viruses. But unlike Ebola Zaire, which is the Ebola virus that we've most likely all of us have heard more about in the last few years, it's the one that's been causing multiple outbreaks in DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Guinea, also was the cause of the 2014-16 West Africa outbreak. And there was a vaccine developed against this virus that's currently licensed here in the United States, but there is no licensed vaccine available for Sudan virus. And Sudan virus is spread just like any other Ebola virus or filovirus by human-to-human transmission, by a direct contact. It is not spread through airborne transmission. And the incubation period can range from 2 to 21 days, but typically is anywhere between 7 and 10 days on average. And infected persons are not considered contagious until they become symptomatic. Next slide, please. So just a current outbreak update in terms of the number of cases and some other information. As of yesterday, there are a total of 115 cases of Sudan virus in Uganda, 95 of which have been confirmed and 20 are probable. The total number of deaths is a total of 52, 32 of those being confirmed case deaths and 20 probable deaths, with a case fatality proportion of 45.2%. The total recoveries or people that have had Sudan virus infection and have recovered from that and been discharged is now at 34. And the number of affected districts stands at 7. You can read them there, but of note, more recently, the capital city of Kampala and also just a surrounding district of Wakiso have started to have cases, as well as transmission of cases, infection from contacts of those initial three cases that were identified a couple weeks ago. So, but the majority of the outbreak is still centered in the Mubende and Kasanda areas, the site of the original point of infection in the outbreak. The total number of infections in healthcare workers is at 15, with 4 of those being deaths. And the contact tracing has been relatively, it's been a relatively high percentage of contacts followed, ranging usually around the mid-90s. This particular update is showing 99% followed in the last 24 hours with 1,844 active contacts. But this has ranged anywhere from, you know, about 85% up to, 95% on average. Next slide. And with this, I'm going to pass it to my colleague, John Klenna, to give the current Uganda laboratory update over for me.
Thanks, Trevor. So hi, everyone. This is John Klenna. I'm here currently in Uganda. There are 2 laboratories right now that are doing testing for the Sudan Ebola virus in Uganda. There is the Uganda Virus Research Institute, which CDC has supported for a number of years now. And then the Central Public Health Laboratory through the National Public Laboratory, using equipment from the East African community that was really instrumental for their response to COVID. That laboratory is set up in the Mubendi district right next to the Mubendi Regional Referral Hospital and is doing testing on site. I currently have only a little bit of visibility on the testing that's being done at the Mubendi site. So the numbers I'm going to give you is about half of what we're seeing in total for testing. And it's really only the Uganda Virus Research Institute numbers. So since the September the 19th, when the first case was diagnosed at UVRI, UVRI has received about 867 samples. Up until October 7th, those samples were coming in from Mubende. After October 7th, those samples were really coming in from other parts of the country. And in the last 10 days or more, or so, a little bit more than that, probably. It's been a very heavy load coming in from the capital city, Kampala. Out of those 867, about 84 samples have tested positive for the Sudan Ebola virus. And those 84 represent 66 unique cases. So the other 18 are repeat tests for already known cases of Sudan Ebola virus. The Mubendi laboratory, based on an update today, has tested over 600 samples since they were operational about October 1st. And at UVRI, in addition to testing for the Sudan Ebola virus, the UVRI staff is also testing for other viral hemorrhagic fever causes, including Ebola Zaire, Ebola Bundibugyo, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, and Rift Valley fever. Also, along with that load, they're doing testing for Sudan. They're doing whole genome sequencing for Sudan. And up to now, 17 complete genomes have been generated for the Sudan strains that have come out of this outbreak. In addition, five samples have tested positive for Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. It was averaging about one per week since the beginning of the outbreak. Two of these were fatal. And just to point out that two of these cases, not the two that were fatal, only one of these was fatal. They were found in samples that were also circulating in Mubende. And so, you know, in addition to having Sudan virus in Mubende, there was also this Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever outbreak circulating at the same time. I think that's the end for me. And I think we're back over to Julie for the next slides.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate everybody joining today, especially John from Uganda. So I want to talk about where we are right now in the with the U.S. risk of Sudan virus spread. So WHO has assessed the risk for spreading as low. Uganda, clearly this is their fifth outbreak, and they did have an outbreak of Zaire in 2019. They have experience, unfortunately, responding to Ebola virus disease. There is exit screening that's occurring in Uganda of people that are getting on planes. And right now, the risk of importation into the United States is currently assessed as low. There are a low number of travelers every day to the United States that come from Uganda. There are no direct flights to the United States. And in the United States, there is entry screening of those U.S.-bound travelers from Uganda in the five airports where they are arriving. Can I have the next slide, please? Now we're going to talk a little bit about some of the domestic preparedness activities. Next slide. So as you may know, CDC has activated the emergency response structure within the center to be able to respond to this outbreak. We are standing up several multidisciplinary CDC Ebola response teams or CERT teams. These teams will be ready to go in case there is an imported case in the United States to be able to help support our jurisdictions with response. We're updating our guidance on patient management with suspected Sudan virus. There are a whole lot of websites that were pasted in the chat, and I strongly encourage you to look at these, not just once, but often, as they will be continually updated as this outbreak progresses. And we're also outlining a process to access experimental Sudan virus therapeutics. Next slide. In terms of testing, we are working with the Regional Emerging Special Pathogen Treatment Centers. There are 10 of them in 10 HHS regions across the US, as well as 28 LRN laboratories to be able to conduct testing for Sudan virus. We're also preparing treatment centers are preparing specialized high-level isolation units. They are equipped with infrastructure, laboratory testing capabilities, and staff to be able to care for patients with highly hazardous communicable diseases. Next slide, please. So the test that's being used is called the BioFire Film Array NGDS Warrior Panel, and it is cleared by the FDA as an IVD, and it detects multiple Ebola viruses that are listed on the slide. This is an assay that was developed by the Department of Defense and is in use right now for U.S. Biodefense or U.S. Department of Defense laboratories and laboratories designated by the Department of Defense. The next slide. The result that will happen from the BioFire NGDS Warrior Panel will be a presumptive test result, and that will happen right now at 22 LRN laboratories throughout the U.S. and 4 of the Regional Emerging Special Pathogens Treatment Centers. So that means we are standing up 28 labs as well as the 10 regional treatment centers, but now we have 22 and 4 that are able to do the testing right now under CLIA. And again, this would be a presumptive positive, and any presumptive positive test result must be confirmed at CDC. Next slide. Some things to consider with diagnostic testing. So a negative real-time PCR test result from a blood specimen collected from a symptomatic patient less than 72 hours after symptom onset does not rule out infection. So there will be guidance if that happens on what the next step should be. If it's more than 72 hours after symptom onset, then that test result will rule out Ebola virus disease. Next slide. So things to think about for laboratory testing. This testing requires whole blood EDTA. And the volume for adults is at least 4 milliliters, and for a child, at least 1 milliliter. The specimen are to be collected in plastic tubes with EDTA, as shown in the slide. And if you're going to be shipping this specimen, and we'll talk a little bit more detail about packaging in a minute, but the shipping conditions to a designated LRN laboratory would be on cold packs. And if you send to CDC, it would be shipped on dry ice. Next slide, please. Okay, that's all for me. Thanks.
So now we'll talk about some general guidance for laboratories handling specimens suspected of Ebola. The next couple of slides will actually discuss a LOCS message that went out on October the 19th. Although the risk of a travel-associated Ebola case in the U.S. is low, CDC still recommends that clinical laboratories actually start reviewing information on specimen collection and transport of infectious substances safely suspected of containing Ebola virus. Most of the Ebola cases will likely have other diseases, especially if the patient has no high risk exposures. Laboratories will still need to be able to perform a non-Ebola test while waiting to rule out an actual Ebola, positive Ebola specimen. CDC recommends that the Ebola testing should only be ordered and performed if patients who meet the actual criteria for patients under investigation for an Ebola virus. This means that before collecting specimens or any Ebola testing, clinical laboratories must contact the State Department, and the State Department will actually contact CDC. Next slide, please. I think I kind of spoke about a little about this. I will mention that the third bullet, part of the reason why we want laboratories to continue doing other testing is that, you know, there may be some cases where, you know, there's some similarities or symptoms that are related to malaria, especially if the patient or participant has actually traveled in a malaria high area. Next slide, please. If testing is needed, CDC will actually provide guidance, as Julie spoke about, for how to actually collect the specimen, and also a shipping instructions based on if they're going to ship the specimen to a public health laboratory or to ship to CDC. Next slide, please. If testing is needed, they should follow, when it comes to packing and shipping, should follow the CFR 173.96 Category A infectious substance packing and shipping requirements. These specimens are not considered select agents because they haven't actually been identified to contain the actual Ebola virus disease. So that means with them not being a select agent, the request to transfer select agent and toxins does not apply. Next slide, please. As always, we always want laboratories to perform a risk assessment. This is actually something that could be done now, or if you did complete a risk assessment years ago, you can actually go back and revisit that risk assessment for Ebola virus. So some of the things that you really want to consider when you're doing a risk assessment is, you know, what are the procedures that are going to be involved in that particular laboratory? What are your hazards? The path of the sample, I think sometimes laboratories forget to include, you know, how's the sample going to travel throughout your laboratory? And if a sample has to be, a confirmatory sample has to be submitted to a public health laboratory or CDC, how are you transporting that sample? Or if you have a patient on a floor, you want to take in consideration about using pneumatic tube system. It is definitely not recommended to use a pneumatic tube system to transport samples that have the potential to be Ebola virus. So you would want to consider how your clinical staff is going to transport that sample throughout the building back into the laboratory. You want to also think about the training of your personnel, the competency level, as well as because they will be shifting an actual Category A, they need to be certified. So these are opportunities for you to actually look into making sure that the training is, the staff is trained and they're competent in what they're doing, as well as in the packing and shipping process. And along with that, they need to be actual certified. You want to look at the laboratory equipment and the facility, as well as any other additional resources you need. If you need to, you know, think about your emergency response, your spill kits, if they're, you know, need to be checked. Those are the kind of things that you want to kind of keep in mind. We want to actually, you know, be ahead of things instead of, you know, responding to something after it's happened. Also, you want to follow the OSHA bloodborne pathogen standards as well. Next slide, please. When it comes to decontamination, you want to perform routine cleaning of areas that are touched on a regular basis. You want to use an EPA register list L disinfectant to clean those areas. One of the things you want to take into account when we start talking about cleaning, you want to be careful about cleaning a particular instrument that may not be able to withstand one of the disinfectants. So you want to make sure that you have actually read your instruction manual, reached out to the actual manufacturer for that particular instrument if you have any questions. You want to also disinfect the areas where you're handling the specimen, where you're packing the specimens and packaging the specimen. In the event of a specimen specimen gets spilled during the packing shipping process, you also want to be prepared to actually have a special kit set up for that particular area if you have a designated area for packing and shipping. Next slide, please. I don't like to use the word easy to disinfect the Ebola virus, but I'll say if you are doing it properly, and effectively, it can be easily decontaminated. So with that being said, we want to kind of, spray the surface contact, for at least 3 minutes using one of the disinfectants on the EPA Register L list. And as always, you want to follow the manufacturer's instructions for concentration to confirm contact time, the care, and the handling of that actual disinfectant, as well as, again, I'll stress again, as those instruments, because not all of the instruments, you can directly spray them. Next slide, please. Waste management. We wanted to take into account that the materials that are contaminated or suspected of being contaminated with Ebola are regulated as Category A infectious substances under the DOT HMR CFR parts 171 through 181. And I recommend that you actually do go out and visit the actual regulations to make sure that your staff and everyone understands exactly what the regulation says and if they are prepared. You also want to speak with the actual contract company that removes your waste from your actual site. Additionally, you can look at some procedural guidelines on properly packaging Ebola waste seen in managing solid waste contaminated with Category A infectious substance from the DOT. Next slide, please. And I'll stress again, all waste disposal must comply with your local regulation, regional, state, national, and international regulations. So you should also visit the state universal waste program as from EPA, as well as actually going to your state. Your states actually have sites, public health sites have information that you actually can pull based on what the regulations may be for your particular region or state. I actually said that you should speak with your waste contract management contractor. Next slide, please. And now I'll turn it over to, I'm not sure if the Brian is going to do packing and shipping.
Sorry about that. I was looking over some of the questions floating by. Okay. Well, hello, everybody. I didn't send in my bio, but I'm Brian Harcourt, Viral Special Pathogens, Biosafety Officer and Select Agent Principal Investigator. I've been around CDC in some capacity since 1994. I was about 20 years in virology and 9-ish in bacteriology with bacterial meningitis. And I've been in viral special pathogens again since late 2015 as their safety officer. So with that little catch up, can we have the next slide, please? Okay, minimize something so I can see the whole screen. As we've kind of already reviewed, the specimens from PUIs or confirmed EVD cases with a star on that should be packed and shipped as Category A infectious substances in accordance with the link shown there. The only caveat here is if you have a confirmed by isolation is our current definition Ebola virus case, then that specimen would be a select agent. So coming in off-site or LRN lab, it would most likely just be category A non-select agent. By the time the person is confirmed as an EVD case by virus isolation, they will already be in a specialized hospital. So just keep that in mind. All persons packing and shipping infectious substances must be trained and certified in compliance with DOT or the IATA requirements every 2 years. I think somebody had asked where can they get that training. I am not sure, but I'm guessing somebody on this call, or if we have experts that can tell you where you get that training. Specimens for shipment should be packed following the triple packaging system, consisting of a primary container, that's a sealable specimen container wrapped with absorbent material, a secondary container that's watertight and leak-proof, and an outer shipping package. Slide, please. So packaging considerations. You must use a UN-approved packaging that has to be noted with UN specification that marks that it has certified the required drop test. Quantity limits and additional markings are based on the mode of transportation, whether that be passenger or cargo. And no replacements or substitutions of packaging materials are allowed. Next. So this is key here. So packing cold specimens. So if you're packing a specimen for that's going to be tested by BioFire in an LRN lab, BioFire requires that the specimen arrive at between 2 and 8 degrees. BioFire cannot be used to test frozen specimens. So ensure that suspected EVD specimens are packed to maintain temperatures of 2 to 8. Within the secondary container, place sufficient ice packs to surround the sealed secondary packaging and also to provide further insulation. It is important to note that surrounding the secondary packaging on all sides with ice packs has been shown to improve the length of time the specimen remains frozen or cold, not frozen, cold during transit. Next, please. All right, now we'll talk about frozen. So if you're shipping specimens to CDC for testing on our assay, we require that it arrive frozen. Apologies for the two different temperatures. That's the way these two assays are going. So you're going to ensure suspected EVD specimens are packed to maintain temperatures of less than minus 20. So within the secondary container, place sufficient dry ice to surround the sealed secondary packaging. And it is important to note, similar to the ice packs, that surrounding the entire container with dry ice improves the length of time the specimen remains frozen during transit. And during these times of logistical difficulty, sometimes the transit time becomes longer than anticipated. So it's really important to get that either dry ice for frozen or ice packs for cold. Be sure that they're really packed in there. Next slide, please. So carrier considerations. So FedEx accepts category A packages. They will not, just for the record, will not ship select agents. But remember, these are category A non-select agents at this point. You cannot use the FedEx clinical pack or clinical box, and you must follow the IATA dangerous goods regulations, PI 620 packing instructions. UPS accepts category A packages. And again, you must follow the IATA dangerous goods regulations and those packing instructions. Additional private carriers may accept category A packages. You can check with the local carriers for more info. Additionally, you know, sometimes those private carriers can get a lot more expensive than FedEx or UPS. Just a word of warning. And do note that the U.S. Postal Service does not accept category A packages. Next. And here's your list of sources. So I turn it over to who's taking this home? Oh, the Q&A, we're all taking it home. Okay.
I will, let's see, there's a question in here saying, where should you go to get a category A certification for staff? I will actually answer that. CDC does offer a packing and shipping course, however, that course really only covers the general knowledge portion of it. There are some additional requirements if you actually go to the IATA org and the DOT links. It'll actually tell you the additional trainings, but the certification ultimately is your facility. Whatever your facility's curriculum that they actually design for you, they will actually then provide the certification and certify that the person actually knows how to do it. One of the new additions that have been added to IATA is that you actually have to perform a COT, and as well as DOT, is that they have to perform a competency exam. And that means that the employer actually has to see the person actually package and ship the samples. Let's see if there's another one here. One of the questions that says that why one of the guidance images show no packaging for a biohazard bag. Specimens. The specimens typically are kept in a biohazard bag. I'm not sure which image you're speaking of. Is that the one from the actual packing and shipping portion or something that's throughout the slides? Because we actually do provide the sample into a biohazard bag. Or if you look at the other packing and shipping diagram, it's going in an actual tube that actually has a packing and has a biohazard label on it. One of the questions is, will the slides be available? Yes, they will. It takes about 2 weeks for everything to be uploaded. There's a question I'm not sure which one from the team would like to answer is this. It says, why is there different volumes for adult and pediatric testing? What age is considered a child?
I'm happy to take a stab at that to start with. It's not so much that there's going to be a difference in the testing between an adult and a child. It's just more difficult to draw a large amount of blood from a child that is suspected of an Ebola case. And so that accounts for primarily why there's a difference in sample volumes and what's collected between the adult and the child.
Here's another one for the team. How is CDC selecting the members of the CERT teams?
Hi, this is Trevor Shoemaker. Maybe I can try and start that. I believe these are the teams that CDC would put together to come out to a state if there was a positive Ebola case and assistance was requested. Those CERT teams are just being rostered here with subject matter experts in the respective areas that may need assistance in states, including epidemiology. We'd have a senior team lead to interact, with the state health department and local health departments. And coordination. We'd have a laboratory specialist, a biosafety specialist, an infection control prevention specialist or any other, data management, anything else that might be in need of assistance, just based on previous outbreaks and imported Ebola cases in previous years. Hope that answered the question. Over.
Let's see. There's a question, where can I find the category A shipping boxes? You could actually purchase them from any of the vendors. I'm not going to say any particular names. So where you get your regular supplies, you can actually contact the actual vendor and see if they actually sell a category A box. I thought UPS only allows 2.5 grams max of dry ice. Is this true? Does anyone from the team want to take it? If not, I'll.
I think it's a good question. It's probably worth following up. I was not aware of that myself, but I think it's worth following up on that to respond back to you. Over.
Yeah, that is true. There actually have been a few changes. I want to say early 22 or that quite the end of 21, where there are some changes to the dry ice. So if we can get that question and actually follow up with the person who submitted this question. This one is, it says, are samples from patients suspected of Ebola that are unconfirmed shipped as category A, or would they be shipped as category B?
That would be category A.
Yeah, maybe just a follow-up on that. So Ebola is an exception to what we think about as the as shipping dangerous substances and dangerous goods. So any suspect Ebola sample, so if you have a sample that's just suspect that it hasn't been tested by PCR, but you suspect that it might be an Ebola case, it has to be sent as category A. So that's the distinction for a suspect Ebola case. And it's a little bit unusual and it falls out of the norm, but you can just remember that because it is an exception to that rule.
And I'll add that it's because Ebola falls on the list for both DOT and for IATA. Anything that kind of falls on those lists as a category A, you have to ship them as category A. Let's see. So, what test rec or form needs to accompany the specimens when sent to the LRN lab? Anyone?
Can you repeat that question, please? I'm sorry.
The question is, what test requisition or form is needed to accompany the specimen when you send it to the LRN lab?
Yeah, this is Julie. Great question. We had a similar question earlier that I replied to, but I would strongly recommend that you reach out to your state or local LRN laboratory to get guidance on this, because every laboratory does things slightly differently. So this is a great time to do that outreach to your LRN labs to better understand what to do in that situation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Can I chime in on one of the questions here?
Sure.
Because there's been a couple of them, and I've had questions emailed me recently and from Uganda. Does the CDC have any recommendation on instruments that should be used for testing on patients who are PUIs? We have concerns with using the instrumentation in the main lab, as many vendors do not have contamination procedures. There is a link. I'm trying to dig it out. I'm not so good at multitasking, so trying to read and answer and research at the same time isn't going well. But Julie is the queen finding these links, so she may have it before I even answer it. So I think for the clinical chemistries, I'm talking to folks in hospitals and whatnot, there are, you know, three different really kind of styles. Maybe there's more. A lot, basically, you can talk to your manufacturer and find out how to. A lot of them, if you know, it's just a matter of bleaching one or two different outside parts or another disinfectant, such as 5% microchem, 3% Lysol, or whatever you use in-house that also works on Ebola. If it works on a non-envelope virus, it's going to work just fine for disinfecting Ebola in general. For your more sophisticated machines, if it has a closed tubing system, many times you can run bleach through it. I talked to a couple of companies that actually have weekly recommended decons that you would have to do. This is a part and parcel of running the machine. And using that material would actually decontaminate the machine. otherwise, things that might be on the outside, like there's a needle that or aspirator that punctures the tube to bring up sample, bleach that. You can run bleach through the system. But the key here is to contact the manufacturer. And I say many vendors do not have contamination procedures. The ones I have talked to do. Sometimes it's difficult to get a response from them, but in my experience is if you mention the word Ebola, you do get a much quicker response. So a pro tip, I guess, maybe for you to mention that, and you can get the companies to respond more quickly. It's kind of rambling, but there are ways around it. And it's really important, I think, to find those ways now, because I know a lot of testing doesn't get done. A lot of chemistries don't get run because people are afraid of Ebola and have a healthy respect for it, of course. But there are ways of decontaminating machinery. You just have to do a little bit of research. Over.
I'll ask one last question. If we have a presumptive positive on BioFire and still need to send a sample, do we still need, I guess you want to say, and still need to send it, or do you, is the question you still want to send a sample to CDC? That will be a select agent or category A, how best to ship?
As Brian again, if it's a positive on a BioFire, it has to be confirmed at CDC. It would not be a select agent. But yes, we would want to have that confirmed, sent to CDC and confirmed. You can call the EOC number and then have a consultation with viral special pathogens on how to ship that and what needs to be done. John or Trevor or Julie?
Yeah, this is Trevor. Maybe one step before you have a positive BioFire is that if, and this is focused on laboratory, but if you have a suspect patient or returning traveler who's ill that was in Uganda and the state EPIs clinicians at the hospital have evaluated and discussed and maybe have a higher level of suspicion that this could be a potential Ebola case or a high suspect Ebola case, consultation with CDC, as Brian mentioned, through calling the EOC, will be patched through to one of us on our team or another clinician here to go through whether or not it needs to, if that suspect case rises to the level that we need to test them. That's usually a consultation most states would like to have with CDC prior to doing the test in the first place, because once you run that test, if it's positive, a lot of things can happen. And then if we do go to that next step of running that test or saying, yes, this person meets the criteria, we should rule out Ebola virus, run the BioFire if that's the closest laboratory that can do the testing. Otherwise, we might be able to take the sample here. As Brian said, if it's presumptive positive by that test, then we can coordinate the shipping with our laboratory. Over.
Thank you all. If you have questions that we didn't answer, you can feel free to actually send them in, and we will actually try to get around to answering your question. Again, I would like to thank our guest panelists for presenting today. I would like to also talk to you about an additional training webinar that will occur. And it will be next Thursday, November the 3rd from 12 to 1. And I like to share not just the title of this one, because it's also about Ebola, but these are actual clinicians who have had the experience of having one of the Ebola patients in their actual hospital. So it will be a great opportunity for you to listen to them, to share with you about the lessons they've learned from receiving samples from patients suspected of and infected with Ebola. And also what their plans are for their actual clinics. You can see the link, I think it's been added into the actual chat for you to go and register for this highly recommended webinar. As reminded, it was one of the questions that was asked earlier about will the slides and be available? And I would say, yes, they will. Give us about 2 weeks, as well as the audio will be also available. And this could be found posted on the cdc.gov, the One Lab link. And I think it has been also added in the chat. And again, I'll say thank you for joining us today and have a great rest of your day. And I will see you all back next Thursday, November the 3rd at